This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. Welcome to a new season of The Money. We're starting with international trade and a world that is moving away from it. Trade will still grow, but not as much as it has, as different countries adjust to new geopolitical realities. And it will look different. Who buys what from whom is changing already. This all comes from a new report by the Boston Consulting Group. Here's senior partner Nicholas Lang.
Well, if you look at our report, the interesting part is that global trade is actually forecasted to grow for the first time in many decades slower than GDP. Not massively slower, but by a few percentage points slower than global GDP. And this is obviously due to a series of reasons. One is we're still seeing the aftermath of the pandemic and, let's say, disrupted long-haul supply chains. We see a further regionalization of trade, what some people call nearshoring or friendshoring. And we obviously see also a disruption of supply chains due to the war in Ukraine. I just was in Davos, and in the sidelines of Davos, the Ukrainian delegation was also very present. And I think it's quite interesting to hear that even President Zelensky is saying that his absolute best case is a war that lasts for another year. And the base case are several years.
Yes.
So I think that's one of the reasons why trade is slower than it was before.
Well, you found that it's not just slower than it was before, but the patterns of trade are changing, starting with what we were just talking about, Ukraine. So what's happening to the relationship between Russia and the West?
Well, Richard, I think what fundamentally changed, and I've been looking at this now for the last 10 years quite intensively, what fundamentally changed is that we are back to a world of blocks. We are back to a world of regional trading patterns and less of global trading patterns. Yeah. And I think that's triggering to a certain extent the feeling that old trading patterns are over. Some people are a little bit fast by saying it's the end of the globalization, which I think is wrong. We see a new way of globalization. But what we definitely see is, let's say, a decrease of the traditional big trading routes between China and the US, between China and Europe, and these being replaced by new trading routes.
Yes. And well, trade between the EU, where you are, and Russia, you think that's going to decline sharply, shrinking by something like $232 billion by 2031?
Well, I think the trade between EU and Russia will sharply decline. And I think you mentioned it. If you look at our global trade forecast, there are three big routes that will decrease. The biggest decrease is Russia-EU, de facto because we see the end of Russian energy export to the EU. You know, the region I'm in used to buy 150 billion cubic meters of gas from Russia. And that's being replaced now by US LNG, Norwegian pipeline gas, Algerian pipeline gas. We are pushing massively renewables and so on. Yeah. So I think that's the big decrease that's driving this trading relationship. The two others that will decrease is US-China, but to a lesser extent, something like around 70 billion. And interestingly enough, the third one to decrease is UK-Europe due to the Brexit.
Yes. So you've mentioned China. In Australia, of course, we probably think of China first, because despite a difficult few years between the two of us, they're still our most important export market. What do their trade dynamics look like?
Well, the trade dynamics for China is quite interesting. So I think we see a continuous decrease between China and US. That will absolutely and relatively decrease, which means that we foresee about 70 billion less trade in the end of the decades than now, which is a decrease of 10% roughly. But we also see a relative decrease of the trade between China and EU. But the big change is a huge increase of trade between China and ASEAN, where we see a growth north of $400 billion. And that has to do first with the role that China plays in Southeast Asia, but also the fact that Southeast Asia has become a big manufacturing hub for Chinese companies, and from there they export in the world. Of course, I think that's one of the big patterns we see.
Yeah, well, look, you mentioned ASEAN, of course, is in our neighbourhood, and you actually see ASEAN as a really big winner in trade terms over the next 10 years or so.
Yes, we are seeing that ASEAN alone will add $1 trillion in trade to its trade balance in the next 10 years. Yeah, and this is largely driven by a series of factors. One is geopolitical tensions. So you have a series of companies who have just directly relocated manufacturing from China to ASEAN. But this is also driven by the Chinese, state policy to saying, well, China wants to become more of a knowledge-based economy and less of a labor cost economy. So that's the second reason. The third reason is that de facto labor cost in many ASEAN countries is lower than China. The fourth reason is that ASEAN, and you know this from an Australian perspective, is an extremely good logistical hub with a good position, good logistical infrastructure. And last, you have very welcoming governments with generous foreign direct investment policies and very active investment promotion agencies. So if you put those five factors together, I think it explains well why the big winner in the next decade will be the ASEAN countries.
I'll ask about Australia in a moment, but you used a phrase earlier, Nick, that I just want to ask you a bit more about, and that is nearshoring and friendshoring. Now, I think both of these are possibly issues in that rise of the ASEAN countries, among other things. But what are you talking about when you say nearshoring, friendshoring?
Yeah, when we look at nearshoring or friendshoring, and we have to go back in the years of the early pandemic, you know, I think it was quite interesting that in the first weeks of the pandemic, our politician realized that in Europe, we're not even able to produce protective gloves or protective masks because we had outsourced everything around the world. Yeah. And the second point people realized is that many of these products did have supply chains of not a couple of days, but of 6 to 8 weeks. What people realized back then is that they had overstretched supply chains to the max just to get a few cents less. And I think the fundamental change that has taken place in the last 3 years is that people have realized that they need to shorten supply chains and to bring it also to countries that might be less risky in terms of political closure. If you look at how many export restrictions took place during COVID, people realized who are their friends and who aren't. And so friendshoring and nearshoring means, bluntly speaking, that instead of getting parts and pieces from China, Europe has refocused on manufacturing a lot of its products in Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, by the way, and Turkey, yeah, and North Africa. So the trade of the last 2 to 3 years from countries like Morocco, Tunisia, Turkey, Ukraine to Europe has increased because of this nearshoring. And obviously for the US, the major nearshoring area is Mexico. And if you look in our trade model, we're expecting the trade between Mexico and US to grow by more than $200 billion between Mexico and US. Yeah. So just to put into perspective, what Europe reduces trade between Russia and Europe, the same value almost increases between Mexico and the US.
That's astonishing. Nick, I want to ask about Australia because we're an open trading nation. We're kind of culturally and financially part of what you might call the West in the old terminology. But of course, we're much closer to Asia, and increasingly we're connected through Asia. What is our outlook in terms of trading?
Look, what we see currently today is, I think, two things. The key takeaways for Australia and New Zealand are that obviously your exports are mainly focused on energy, mining, and agribusiness. And obviously, your primary trading relationship is with China, ASEAN, and Japan, and Korea. You are playing a crucial role in resourcing these growth economies. And so I think this is something which will play, I think, an important role. And what we also see is that, let's say, the growth will continue trade will continue to grow by 3%. We might see a softening of some of the commodity export prices. But overall, I would say we see a steady growth of trade in Australia around, I would say, 3% per year, which brings the trade from Australia from currently 270 billion or so to 370 billion. So actually a positive outlook. We're still China, ASEAN, Japan remaining important destinations for your trade. However, let's say also a little bit stronger growth around Latin America, EU and USA. I think Australia and New Zealand tries to diversify a little bit its trading partners because, as we say today, the relationship is, I think, very dependent. 3/4 of your exports go to these Asian destinations.
Mm. Now, before I let you go, Niklaus, Davos just finished. You were there the other day. It wasn't exactly upbeat, but the mood was more positive than it has been. How well do you think the trade concerns that you've identified, how well do you think they're understood?
Well, you know, Richard, I was in Davos, I think, since 2013. So I've seen the ups and downs of the last decade, including the virtual Davoses during the pandemic. And especially, I think what is interesting is to compare the mood of last May. If you remember, the Davos was pushed from January to May because of COVID. So the first in-person Davos 2022 took place in May, and obviously that was 3 months after the invasion. I think the mood was not very good. Now it was a bit, I would say, mixed. Yeah, I think what I took away from Davos is that people realize very concretely that geopolitics is becoming a very important impact factor for every CEO. And if you just let me, Rich, say one anecdote, which I found very interesting, is I hosted a dinner of 24 CEOs, global CEOs of 13 different countries. And one of these CEOs said one sentence, which I found very interesting. He said, you know, Niklaus, digital appeared on my agenda 10 years ago. Climate and sustainability appeared on my agenda 5 years ago. And geopolitics appeared on my agenda on February 24th, 2022. And I think that describes the situation quite well, where people realize that they have to live in another world, in a much more complex world. And this is why it's difficult to say, well, people were pessimistic or optimistic. I think with regard to economy, people were more optimistic than I thought. People hope for a soft landing. People think that we will not go into a deep recession in Europe. But at the same time, they say, well, we've seen how much a war can interrupt all supply chains, can interrupt economy. And that's why people are not too optimistic because of the complexities and intricacies of this new world.
Niklaus, it's been great to get your insights today. Thank you very much for joining us on The Money.
Richard, it was a pleasure. All the best from snowy Munich.
You just heard us talking about China, the world's most important manufacturer and huge market, not just for us here. So when new figures on the Chinese economy came out the other day, they were immediately scrutinised around the world, including by Stephen Joske, former Treasury economist and longtime China specialist. Stephen, what do these numbers tell us?
To be honest, not too much, because, I mean, there's always a danger of overinterpreting 1 month's data. And also bear in mind that the national accounts is always backward looking. So we sort of already knew what was going to happen anyway. But on top of that, there are some unusual things going on. You know, there are a lot of accusations that the data was faked or fudged. And basically the simple thing that stands out is it looks to all intents and purposes as if China actually is in a recession and certainly was at the end of last year. It didn't quite show up some of the components of the figures, like retail sales were surprisingly strong.
Considering there was a COVID lockdown at the time.
Exactly, yeah. And plus, there are things going on too, like some fairly stagnant world trade and the supply chain issues caused by lack of semiconductors is still persisting, and that has a big effect on Chinese exports too. So there's clearly some things didn't add up. Now, it's fair to say when there's a recession, which is pretty unusual in China, but when there is a recession on that, they'll try and fake their way out of it and pretend it didn't happen. In fact, this did happen once in the past, back in 1999, 2000, instead of the wash-up from the Asian financial crisis did hit China. And there's pretty strong evidence from the date of time that they did conceal a recession for political reasons, and I suspect they're doing the same now.
Right. So, Stephen, you have been looking at the Chinese economy for a long time. So if we expand the scale and get away from what monthly figures do or do not tell us, what are the trends that matter?
Well, the really key trend is basically for the past 10 years and a bit, the Chinese economy has been steadily slowing. That's quite a contrast to the previous decade where it grew stronger than expected and boomed year after year. So there's a very strong slowing trend. And the question is, how fast will it slow down? And at the extreme end, there are some people out there who think China may actually stagnate. So it's just an interesting question. Are there any signs of China just about to slow but not pick up afterwards?
Mm. The question, I suppose, that people are most concerned about now is how quickly the economy bounces back after abandoning that zero COVID approach. It's been written and talked about a lot this week, Stephen. It won't have escaped you. Mm-hmm. It very much seems like people are desperate for this to happen.
Yeah. Well, they've got some strong evidence from history on their side. I mean, the vast majority of economic downturns, recessions, whatever, are all V-shaped. It's very rare to have a sharp downturn and for it to stay down for a long time. But if you look at China, I don't think it has the ingredients of a prolonged recession at the moment. Certainly there are some problem sectors in the economy, but there's also a willingness of the government to support short-term growth. And they've got, you know, some fairly competitive sectors, you know, both domestically and the export sector. So there's no real reason why they can't pick up quickly. But that said, there are some big risks there, and it's even possible that they could end up going double dip recession if some of those come back to hit them.
That's important globally, of course, because for months last year, it was starting to seem as if the world was heading for a global recession with what was happening in North America and what was happening in Europe. Of course, the Ukraine situation feeds into both of those things. And also the COVID zero approach of China meant that demand was very much down there too. So if they avoid recession, if they come out of it, that will be a good thing for the world not going into recession, but it will come with other problems.
Yeah, it's not a very simple equation for China because it can come out of recession, but the policy of coming out of it can open up other issues which require quick action, which could well slow the economy down again. China has two problems, I guess. One is that it is very vulnerable to the global economic cycle. You know, if the US goes back into recession, that really hits China's exports. The other problem is, for quite a few years now, the Chinese financial system has more or less been on the edge of a financial crisis. And so far, it hasn't happened. But obviously, now they're actually probably in a real recession. It does put a lot of pressure on a whole lot of areas of the financial system with not enough revenue coming in. And we're certainly seeing really strange things happening in China. Like, for example, people on the public payroll in hospitals and the police forces not getting their full salary, which is really quite unprecedented. So I think in the short term, those are the two challenges facing China, a US recession and how to handle it, and their own risk of a financial crisis.
Of course, if they can manage to avoid it, the demand will drive up commodity prices again and fuel inflation, certainly around the world, which could be good for us in Australia. We sell commodities to China after all, but not good for the world.
Yep. Although I look at that only as a short-term phenomenon, because clearly, you know, with the demographic transition in China, there will be a need for much lower rates of growth in the housing stock. And it's not at all certain that they can just keep pump priming the construction sector indefinitely and it not having any consequences for the financial sector.
I'm glad we got to that, Stephen. And we talked about the Chinese property sector last time you were on. Of course, property is the biggest asset class, previously a big driver of growth. The government now seems to be walking back its previous decisions to reduce risky lending and speculation.
That's right. It's the same trade-off. All financial managers around the world have some very nasty trade-offs at the moment. In the US, it's interest rates versus inflation. In China, it's very much the property sector versus the health of the financial system. And how long can they keep kicking the can down the road is a difficult question. I suspect they probably will make a mistake and things will go crazy in the short term, but we'll have to wait and see because so far they've avoided it.
That gets us to, I suppose, decision-making, policy-making by the Chinese government. How good has it been?
Over the past 10 years, it's been more prone to mistakes than a lot of people realise. We can see very big examples of policy failures, like the craziness of the COVID lockdown and the clampdown in Hong Kong, which has really destroyed a lot of business confidence in Hong Kong, for example. You know, they're not black and white issues, but clearly the thing that stands out is that they pushed both those things too far. They didn't really know how to calibrate it and when to back off. That's actually a thing that's become surprisingly common in the past decade. Part of it is due to the Chinese economy maturing and becoming requiring more sophisticated management, which they're still getting used to. And part of it is simply the centralization of a lot of decision-making that's occurred in the past 10 years. You know, there's too much waiting for directions from the top. Like, for example, even an organization like the People's Bank of China probably hasn't got enough authority to make its own decisions anymore compared to what it did 15 years ago.
Which means that it's ultimately political rather than economic. I was reading in the Financial Times the other day, and a Chinese financial researcher was saying China's policies are always about seizing the moment, which I have to say surprised me a little because I thought they were very focused on the future.
I'm not sure we should overanalyze that question because they do have a range of long-term policies, but often there are clear examples when they don't seize the moment, like tax policy in China is basically a history of inaction for decades. They've always talked about addressing the housing bubble by raising the capital gains tax on housing to more realistic levels. They've never done it, despite a lot of work being done on setting in place the framework for implementing it. I think the key thing to bear in mind with China is the focus of policy in China is always political, and it's very much about creating a stable environment for the Chinese Communist Party to stay in power, which means, for example, they're desperate to avoid sharp downturns in the housing market if they're worried about mass employment of construction workers, for example. So that the political stability things, just as we see in Hong Kong and Xinjiang, are always the primary focus, and they're prepared to sacrifice the economy to maintain political control. That's a pattern that keeps recurring.
Stephen, it's been good to get your analysis. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Good, thank you.
China macroeconomic specialist Steve Ajoski. Staying with China, the biggest announcement, one that had been anticipated for a while actually, was that their population is now declining. This demographic change will have a huge impact on the world economy, and a lot more besides, over decades. And it's highlighted the growth of loneliness in China, which has its own set of implications. Leo Lewis is the Asia business editor of the Financial Times.
So loneliness is one of these effects, a side effect or a major effect of these big population changes that we've seen elsewhere in the region. Japan, where I live particularly, has been ahead of this. And what it is that the big social changes that actually bring about this decline in population, which is people finding partners later in life, not having children, growing into old age, often without grandchildren. These are all contributing factors to what amounts to an epidemic, really, of loneliness. That's to say, people who can go for days on end without meeting a friend, identifying family members that live nearby them. And so you've got a big collection, I guess, of social changes and social conditions which are contributing to this big growth in loneliness. And a country like China, where the population numbers always surprise us with, these very, very large numbers. We identified this as an issue that's going to be very, very big in China and is going to get greater as these demographic trends get bedded in.
Yeah, and of course, it's not that long ago that they had a one-child policy. It's only relatively recently been abandoned. Of course, that would have had a huge kind of ripple effect.
That's right. And the thing about demographics, the famous line is it's the future that's already happened. The thing about demographics is that they play out over decades and you can see what's coming. So the effects of the one-child policy that was in place for a long time, and it's a shorthand for a lot of different kind of demographic control policies in China. But fundamentally, it was there to create the conditions that to some extent we're seeing now. And you can see in some of the policy statements, in some of the more general conversations in China, there's now a concern that it may have gone too far, that what you've got now with this shrinking population and this aging population are kind of problems that were created by the one-child policy, and that demographics being what they are, you can't reverse it quickly.
But you point out, Leo, it's not just the one-child policy, because you've already mentioned Japan, I think Taiwan, South Korea, they've already been having to tackle this as well.
That's right. Japan is a particularly strong example, because I guess they were identifying their kind of trajectory of their population from, you know, the late 80s and certainly in the 90s, it was a real cause of concern in Japanese media. They could see that what was coming was that they had long ago fallen below kind of replacement levels, and they were heading to an inflection point that did come in the 2000s, where the population would start shrinking. And other countries, Taiwan, South Korea, those are countries that have also seen the problem coming, and try as they might, they cannot seem to reverse this decline. And it's to do with, you know, these social changes that these aren't bad social changes in themselves, but they do create an issue that then amounts to, you know, some pretty big policy challenges for the government's concern.
Yes, but the government's policy challenge is going to be somebody's opportunity, and you've written that fund managers are analysing, I suppose, the goods and services of the loneliness economy. Before we get into the bits and bobs of that, how do they kind of research something like that?
Well, it's difficult in many ways because it overlaps with a number of different themes. So, you know, for a long time, Japan, for example, and China latterly, has been looking at what are the sort of investment themes for having an elderly population, a very large number of people and a very large proportion of the population aged over 65 and in retirement. And you can look at things that they might spend their money on, you know, how they might invest, how they might look at the world. And people have been doing that for a while, and it's not always played out that successfully. And equally, if you look at the other end of the population, you can try and work out what it is that young people may spend their money on if they have disposable income. You're making a load of guesses. But one thing that you can now say for sure, fund managers have been looking at, is that you have got a very distinct population of lonely people. That's to say, people who will, when surveyed, answer the question and say, I don't have a close friend. You know, I haven't seen a family relative for X number of months. You know, you can start to identify those people. Of course, what investors like is identifiable groups of people. And I don't think a lot of people have been giving much thought to the idea that this sort of loneliness population was a fixed thing. But I think now that it is more identifiable, you've got investors looking at perhaps how we could work out what it is that those people are likely to consume and how they're going to spend money and so on.
So what are the industries that will be able to, I suppose, make use of this epidemic of loneliness?
We are looking now at this at a very early stage. That, in other words, the idea of investment in loneliness is so very young as an idea. I mean, we're talking, you know, within the last couple of years that it's been sort of identifiable, that how it evolves is actually going to take its own shape. At the moment, you know, you can look at the tech side of things, and you can look at the way in which tech is, for example, it's creating ways for people who are lonely to find their way into communities, either virtual or real. And then you've got at the other end, you know, okay, what are we going to do with very lonely old people? And again, people have been looking at the pet market in China. Goldman Sachs put out a report that said, you know, this is a $30 billion market in China. You know, I think there was a statistic that one of the analyst quotes said, there are more cats and dogs owned by people in Japan than there are children under the age of 15. You know, these are very, very large numbers of pet owners. And for those that don't want real pets, there are robot pets. And I think the idea is that the market will find ways to meet the needs of people who identify loneliness as their biggest problem.
That pet market that you mentioned, 30 billion in China, you would think almost would be a mature market, but it's not, is it? I mean, in America, more people have dogs and more people have cats. And of course, they spend more on them. We're looking over 100 billion for the American market. So potentially that 30 billion may barely be the start of the pet market.
That's exactly right. And I mean, you know, that's one of the things that people have started looking at. Think about, okay, well, let's make some projections of the number of people that might consider themselves lonely. And one of the sort of demographic sections they look at is people who are not only living alone, which is, you know, there are plenty of people who live alone for one reason or another, but people who are alone and single. And that particular group of people is not just already a very large constituent of pet ownership in China, for example, but also, you know, in Japan and elsewhere. But it's a growing number. If you look at the projections of where that group of people will grow, you know, tens of millions in the case of China, that's a very big potential market if a third of them own pets.
I think, Leo, that Japan, again, is ahead here. And you did mention robotic pets. So that I think that's already happening in Japan. And, of course, it could be something massive in China.
That's right. And I mean, I think when we talk about robot pets, we're talking about a whole kind of suite of different technologies. These are essentially robot comforters, and those are beginning to become much more standard in Japanese care homes and nursing homes and so on. And again, with Japan, we're talking about a very large proportion of the population. We're not very far off Japan having nearly 30% of the country over 65. And I think last year was the first time that the number of people over 75 reached 15% of Japan's population. And so just the projections alone tell you that if that's what people find helpful, that's going to be a very, very big market for those kind of comforting technologies.
One of the other changes that we've been able to map is this not just increase in loneliness, but an increase in people living in the big cities, and that to the detriment of the regions. And that is something the Japanese government has been trying to address with things like financial incentives to move out of Tokyo, for example. Is that working?
So that really is starting to become more kind of extreme. And like you just mentioned, you know, I think they're offering the equivalent to Tokyo is offering, it's around the equivalent of $10,000 per child. So that's a family, you get ¥1,000,000 per child if you move out of Tokyo. Now, these are very extreme kind of attempted incentives. And what they're trying to do is to encourage the regions to regrow, to sort of revitalize regions where, as you say, the majority of the young population has moved out because the jobs and the opportunities, and let's be honest, the fun of being in a big city outweighs the pull of being close to your family. And so, you know, Japan, and particularly Tokyo, has become this huge magnet of population migration away from the regions. And when you look at this scheme that the Japanese are running to try and encourage people to get out to the towns and villages, they put their websites to say, you know, please come and live in this place. But they have to be honest about the population ratios. And some of these places, you're seeing 40 to 50% of the population in those towns and villages are above retirement age. So, you know, the incentive for young people, yeah, the financial incentive, it sounds pretty good. But you then move to a place where, you know, there aren't that many families in their 30s. And that's, I suppose, the difficulty. And to be honest, at the moment, this scheme has not taken off. I think the statistics from 22 were that only 2,500 people took the bait and moved out of Tokyo. Now, that in a population of 15 million is a very, very small number. But you could argue that it might be starting. You know, we could be just seeing the very early days of a scheme that's starting to work. But, I think it's going to have to be around for a few years before we can really see whether it's working. At the moment, it doesn't look like it has.
It really is fascinating to sort of see this happening and at different points in different countries. Leo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That's Leo Lewis at the FT. He's based in Tokyo. Thanks for listening to The Money. If you're doing it via the ABC Listen app, very easy to subscribe so that you don't miss it. Next time, we'll look at the regulation of BNPL, Buy Now, Pay Later. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. I'm Richard Aidy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.